Good morning. January 2021, eh? If you're hanging on by your fingernails, you're not alone.
Remember for ages we talked, the vaccines are coming, the cavalry is coming. Then it got here and no, I don't like that vaccine. No, he got one, they got one, I want one. And Mars is slower than theirs, theirs is slower than theirs, ours is bigger than theirs. Now I want 15 vaccines out of that one, even though the pot only says you can only have 4. That's not fair. His sister got one.
Yeah, losing it. And the newsroom's not helping.
Just amazing. Hey, how depressing was Morning Ireland today? Honest to goodness, I mean, sometimes their job is so hard and they do it so well to deliver the news. And I was listening into it this morning and my shoulders dropped with every hour, every minute, because it does seem that the lockdown's pretty bleak and the outlook's pretty bleak. Anyway.
Even the weather is out to get them.
You know when the rain is prohibitively horrible, where it falls and it feels personal, each drop. Each drop, just to really hit you. But Paul Anthony Jones tweeted, "I'm going for a stupid walk in a stupid outside to get some stupid fresh air because everything's stupid." That's pretty much where we're at. That's why I'm looking for an adult in the room to say when the stupid thing.
Back on message line, quick. Reading. But when is it going to end? Not for a while yet, it seems. And even when it does, will we all sit around awkwardly, gently rocking, staring at our hands, not a word to throw to a dog?
Joe's really gone, and no one can do it. And I challenge anyone to do it properly now. Small talk. Small talk is dead. No one can small talk anymore because you have nothing to talk about. That's what's happened. How was the weekend? Yeah, good. What'd you get up to? Did you go for a pint? Nope. Did you go for coffee with anyone? Nope. Did you plan your holidays? Nope. Are you up to anything or no? Nope. Nothing. Nope. Do you have a dog? Nope. I walked the dog. Great. How was that? Great. This is exhausting. Small talk has died because we just haven't enough to talk about other than the same thing that's going on and over and over again.
Round and round our 5K like little COVID hamsters. But no such struggling for small talk in the afternoon. Behold the Darcy. No topic too lowly for Kildare's finest. Courtesy of Texter Mark.
We got a new soft closed toilet seat. Off the charts. Ah, you see, there's the good stuff, lads. That's the good stuff. You can't help but watch it slowly close all the way. It's amazing. That's Mark, I'm with you. So I know what you do. You stand there and you watch it and you go, look at that. And you probably, you know what's going to happen? When lockdown's over, you'll have people around and you go, come in and have a look at our new soft closed toilet seat. There'll be a couple of glasses of wine involved before you do that. But you will, because you know you want to.
Oh, God help me, but I think I do. But it is no word of a lie to say that we're just dragging ourselves through the month as best we can. However, Dr. Brendan Kelly has just written a book called Coping with Coronavirus, How to Stay Calm and Protect Your Mental Health. A psychological toolkit, a mood spanner, if you will. And he spoke to Ray on Monday about the particular qualities of this lockdown.
This time it's different, it's darker, it's deeper.
This time is it feels different, it feels darker, it feels longer, and it's more difficult to, you know, the things that kept us going initially in this pandemic, they just seem a little more jaded. It is important we talk about this. So many people have resilience, they have strategies and techniques, but they're just feeling a bit tired by it at this stage.
Ain't that the truth? But the good doctor had some advice on how to mind ourselves. And if you work in the newsroom, Gavin, Audrey, Anya, Rachel, Mary and Dobbo, you might want to put your fingers in your ears for this next bit.
Knowing is a big thing. We can overload on coronavirus news, can't we?
We certainly can. We can overload on statistics and numbers and all kinds of other negative news. Now, it is important to stay informed. So I usually advise people to tune into the global pandemic for 15 minutes twice a day maximum. So, you know, listen to the news, listen to the updated health advice, whatever the new advice is, how it changes a little bit, but don't listen to the global pandemic news between times. We can't go through every day carrying the weight of a global pandemic on our shoulders. It does impact our lives, but we shouldn't try to, if you like, deal with the whole world's problems when we have problems of our own.
Palpitations for the news hands out there. And lest you think a sneaky scroll of Twitter is okay, but no, put it away.
Well, our brains are very peculiar things, Ray, honestly. What our brains do, particularly on social media, is we move toward the most unlikely, most outrageous and clearly untrue messages or conspiracy theories. And while we dismiss them often in our heads, they still have an emotional impact. So it is important we focus on the reliable news sources and information sources like the Department of Health, the HSE, you know, and RTE. Yeah. And so forth, that we try to focus on these, because even the other sources which aren't true, they do impact on us emotionally over time.
And that's interesting, because you mentioned that a good few times in the book, and I didn't realise this, that even if you, when you read them, you dismiss them, they're still just chipping away at you.
They are. They still pack a punch. And right. Often we'll read something that's entirely and clearly untrue and outrageous and wrong. But not only will we entertain it for a moment before dismissing it, we might even share it with somebody else and say, look, isn't this ridiculous?
Okay.
But and if, even if they dismiss it, it still has an emotional, it packs an emotional punch. And our bodies store up these emotions, even if our logical brains dismiss the information.
And rather than revert to our traditional coping mechanisms, drink and repression, Brendan Kelly wants us to feel it.
And you say in your book to lean into your emotions. And I've read this in loads of different books, sit with your emotions. Will you explain why you should do that?
Well, you see, emotions are overpowering when we're feeling them. They feel infinite, particularly anxiety, particularly about the pandemic. It can feel so big. So certainly what I advise in terms of emotions is if you just sit and notice your emotion and try not to get distracted too much. Simply sit with it and feel it fully, and then feel how it changes or how it diminishes or what your thoughts are surrounding it. We tend to expand on negative thoughts. So, for example, I might feel down today. I might have a difficult day. Yeah. And I might say, I'm having a difficult day. I'm not very good at my job. There's a pandemic. Everything is hopeless. I can't cope. Nobody can. And it just spirals out of control. And if we sit with those thoughts, we'll see how they are amplifying themselves. And maybe the best way to interrupt them is by doing something, taking an action. We can't always think our way out of negative thoughts, but we can sometimes behave our way out of negative thoughts, yes. If that makes sense.
Good advice. But he would say to call this past 12 months a new normal would be a mistake.
This is not normal. This is abnormal, if you like. And we need to remember that. We need to remember this is tough. We need to be compassionate towards ourselves, lower our expectations. But this set of restrictions is different, because while it feels darker to so many people, the light at the end of the tunnel is stronger than it's ever been. Yeah. With the vaccination program coming. And I was vaccinated myself 2 weeks ago. I'm very fortunate as a healthcare worker to be vaccinated. And I can assure you that the psychological boost of vaccination is incredible. Just the atmosphere at the vaccination center was different. It was a kind of an optimism, a positivity, an atmosphere that was unfamiliar to me. It took me a minute to figure it out after all these months, and I realised it was optimism and hope, okay. which is coming.
Dr. Brendan Kelly on coping with coronavirus with Ray on Monday. And while we look to the far field and the jab, who gets it and when is becoming a bit of an issue. Leftover vaccines, anyone? Tension. But that is only the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the vaccine rollout. On Tuesday's News at One, Dr. Margaret Harris of the World Health Organization talked about the need for equitable distribution of the vaccine for all of the world's population, not just for those who can pay.
Dr. Harris, the WHO has also been warning this week of what it characterizes as the possibility of a catastrophic moral failure in relation to the distribution of the vaccine as between the developed and the developing world. Now, there is meant to be a system in place that ensures equal or something approaching equal distribution, but you've obviously got concerns that that's not working the way it should.
Yes, indeed. And we, in fact, started this system called the COVAX facility more than 9 months ago, because we have seen in past huge pandemics that not everybody gets equal treatment, and that the wealthy countries run in and grab all the vaccines or the medicines, and you leave a big chunk of the world untreated. Now, it's understandable that quite often leaders want to look after their own countries first, but it doesn't make any sense, because this pandemic is affecting every part of the world, and we won't be out of trouble. Nobody will be out of trouble until everybody's out of trouble. So we are asking that every country vaccinate the high-risk groups that we've identified, the healthcare and social care workers, and the people in the very, very vulnerable to severe disease, the elderly and people with underlying conditions. But take your time on the rest, and don't buy up all the vaccines, and don't put up the prices and make it so difficult. Leave some for the rest. So that was what Dr. Tedros's clarion call was yesterday.
And later, the issue was debated on Drive Time when Jim Clarkin, Chief Executive of Oxfam Ireland, joined Sarah.
Jim, Oxfam is involved in the People's Vaccine Alliance campaign. What is the position, can you tell us, with access to COVID vaccines for poorer countries at the moment? Where are they in their journey?
Well, they're at the very start of the journey. I mean, Dr. Tedros, when he was making those announcements yesterday, he talked about the fact that there are 30 million doses have been distributed already in 49 higher income countries. In one of the lowest income countries, there have been 25 doses. That's 25, not 250 or 25,000, right. 25 doses. So they're a very long way off. And what we've been saying is that the only real solution to this is to develop this concept of the people's vaccine, whereby the intellectual property that has been developed and the data and the skills and know-how to develop these vaccines is shared, and shared centrally, so that we can get generic companies in developing countries to start to scale up production to a massive scale, so that we can vaccinate the entire globe now. It's not fair to the poorest, most vulnerable people in the world, but also we'll have a problem where variants will continue to pop up around the place.
But Big Pharma, not always known for its altruism.
Would you agree that it seems highly unlikely that pharmaceutical companies would give up the intellectual property rights to something that, you know, that they've worked very hard on over the last year, and which potentially would be something that would provide a lot of revenue for them in the coming years?
Well, what we would say to that is that they have been heavily subsidised by taxpayers' money, by our money, across the world. So these vaccines really should belong to the people. And the pharmaceutical companies are going to make a fortune from this vaccine either way. They're already going to do that. And that's, you know, it's fine that they make money from and make a profit, because they've put such incredible investment and they've developed these amazing vaccines. But they have had tremendous public support. So as a result, the vaccine should be owned by the people. And it is in everybody's interest for the entire globe to be vaccinated as fast as possible.
James Clarkin of Oxfam on Drive Time on Tuesday. On Thursday evening, all 27 EU leaders held a video conference to discuss how best to manage the emerging variants of the virus. Europe editor Tony Connolly spoke to Mary on Friday's Morning Ireland about the drive to get more data from countries.
More member states will need to increase the amount of genomic sequencing they do just to establish those patterns. Ireland sequences about 1% of positive tests, along with a lot of other member states. But a country like Denmark sequences 14%. And the more you can sequence, the more you can establish those patterns and try to get them under control. But the general fear is that these variants are so transmissible potentially that you will need tougher lockdowns.
And what about this whole question of free movement and the introduction of travel bans?
Well, they're looking at that very closely. I think there may well be a travel ban from outside the EU into the EU. In terms of bans within the EU, of course, they want to keep the single market running. But you have a situation where you may have two regions that are bordering each other that have the same very high levels of infection. One region might have a very strict lockdown, the other region doesn't next door, and then people flock across the border to shop, and that's a problem. So they're really keen to try and coordinate any of the lockdown measures as far as possible while keeping the single market as open as possible.
On the same programme, Mary asked Professor James McInerney, head of the School of Life Sciences at the University of Nottingham, about whether it might be possible to tweak ever so slightly the existing vaccines to combat future variants.
So these new platforms, these new kinds of vaccine, you know, if I likened the vaccine particle, if you like, to maybe a house, it's like swapping out a brick in the house and changing it for a new brick. And in which case, well, what we're talking about here is swapping out some of the genetic material that's in the vaccine, so the mRNA, just swapping a small bit of that out and replacing with another bit. It shouldn't change the overall characteristics of the vaccine, we feel, but it would provide protection for these new variants.
Now, the EU meeting yesterday, EU leaders worried about the variants and the transmissibility of the variants, worried about requiring more and further lockdowns. Boris Johnson again yesterday talking about lockdown potentially going on into the summer in the UK, going on here at least into late February, March. Is there another way?
Well, introgression, moving from one place to another is the major cause of spread of this. I mean, it sounds obvious, but it is. So, you know, not wishing to point out the obvious, but Ireland is an island. You know, it can be, you know, sealed. You know, your previous correspondent, I think it was George Lee, was on there, and he was saying that, you know, that lots of people that are coming into Ireland, you know, the screening isn't working or whatever, 40%. I mean, you don't travel when you're sick. You travel when you're asymptomatic, right? You don't think you've got the virus. There are ways of quarantining. There are ways of allowing people into Ireland, but making sure that they're not bringing virus with them. I mean, it seems obvious to me what to do. It seems obvious that you've got to take a New Zealand strategy, or else you're going to be in and out of lockdown for the rest of the year and maybe into 2022, who knows. There is a way out. It is to seal up your borders, and within the country, it is to drive that virus down to zero.
And just like that, we're back again to the thorny issue of all-island mandatory quarantine. James McInerney on Morning Ireland yesterday, but the thought of bliss. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Wednesday, Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, I close the day where I began, with a sacred oath. Before God and all of you, I give you my word. I will always level with you. I will defend the Constitution. I'll defend our democracy. I'll defend America. And we'll give all of you, keep everything I do in your service, thinking not of power, but of possibilities, not of personal interest, but the public good. And together we shall write an American story of hope, not fear, of unity, not division, of light, not darkness, a story of decency and dignity, love and healing, greatness and goodness. May this be the story that guides us, the story that inspires us, and the story that tells ages yet to come that we answered the call of history. We met the moment. Democracy and hope, truth and justice did not die on our watch but thrive. That America secured liberty at home and stood once again as a beacon to the world. That is what we owe our forebears, one another, and generation to follow. So, with purpose and resolve, we turn to those tasks of our time, sustained by faith, driven by conviction, and devoted to one another and the country we love with all our hearts. May God bless America, and may God protect our troops. Thank you, America.
The U.S. had a new president, and Kamala Harris made history by becoming the first female vice president and woman of colour of the United States. On Thursday, when the dust had settled, Irish Times Washington correspondent Suzanne Lynch spoke to Claire and reminded us of how Joe Biden had eventually made it onto that podium.
I think it's important to remember, Claire, just a year ago, people had written off Joe Biden. There was nothing inevitable about this. A year ago, I was in Iowa about this time last year, and, you know, he came last in the Iowa caucus, and the same in New Hampshire. It was only in March that the Democratic Party started coalescing around him. So it's kind of interesting to remember that for us all. You know, there was nothing preordained about this in the last year or two. But I think he has shown that he is the man of the moment now, that Americans are craving some kind of, you know, grandfatherly figure, as somebody who knows what they're doing, experience, etc. And I think it's also worth noting, I mean, we'll be talking about, you know, obviously nearly half the country did vote for Donald Trump. But I think it was Senator Roy Blunt who made the point yesterday at the inauguration. You know, every year at every inauguration, some party has lost. That's the reality. And yes, Joe Biden is talking about bringing the other side together and unifying the country. But he also has the right and the authority now to go ahead and plow on with his ideas as he sees fit. So I think that's important to remember as we keep thinking of, you know, well, the people who vote for Donald Trump, more people did vote for Joe Biden, and that's the way it worked.
And while it may have been Joe Biden's day, the ceremony was notable for who was not there, namely the outgoing president. Because even in his absence, the scent of O'Donald lingered in the air. On Wednesday, Claire Byrne spoke to former FBI director James Comey, who reflected on Trump's legacy.
We know that the far right has always been there, but what has been Donald Trump's role in taking this movement to another level?
Donald Trump has both stoked it and ignited it. That is, you're right. We've always had this radioactive stew of racism, misogyny, conspiracy-minded, violent people in America. It's one of the constant themes, but we pushed it into a corner, down into a basement. Donald Trump not only coaxed it out of the basement, he swelled its ranks with his lies, especially the big lie about the election being stolen. And he gave them the signal. He incited them. Whether he did legally or not is, to my mind, not important. He morally incited them to violence. And so that's his role. It'll be his stain and America's forever.
Later, former U.S. ambassador to the UN and national security advisor John Bolton wanted to vent. He phoned into Liveline to talk to Joe.
Donald Trump doesn't have a philosophy. He doesn't do government policy. It's all about Donald Trump. And what he loves is the pageantry, the ceremony, and the adulation from his supporters. That's what he wants. And I'm sure he's got enough money to keep getting that for the next several years, at least until some of these investigations and lawsuits catch up with him. But in terms of the ability to affect events in Washington, I think, as I say, both critics and supporters have been vastly overestimating the amount of influence he's going to have. Time moves on. There's nothing like being an ex-president to be yesterday's news.
Ooh, harsh. But what about the future of the very fractured Republican Party? Or, as Claire put it,
do you feel like you and the Republican Party have been on a very long, very wild college night out? You've all woken up the next day and nobody really wants to discuss what might have happened.
Claire Byrne, who knew? But is there enough Tato and fizzy pop in all of the world to cure this particular hangover? Well, Claire asked former Washington correspondent Mark Little what future he envisaged for the grand old party.
And I think what we're going to start to see is broadly a fault line between what I would call traditional Republicans, possibly even people who in places like Ohio and Wisconsin and Michigan just drifted away from the Democratic Party toward Trump because he had that populist anti-establishment message, to what extent they still stick with this very hardcore identification with that word patriot, and that is that the government essentially is against the working person, that Trump was the best person who could drain the swamp. And how many of the 74 million are saying to themselves right now, well, Joe Biden actually is someone who does appeal to the working person. And so I think for us right now, there's no way of saying, aside from opinion polls, which still show us that a large amount of those 7 million people stick with Trump, at least in name, but to what extent can those people be peeled away from what we would call the hardcore, those people who self-identify with that word patriot? They're the people right now that I'm watching, and it's not just watching, you know, the bumper stickers in the back of cars. We're seeing online activity in which we're starting to see the emergence of, the Republican Civil War. It's not too strong a way to put it. There's a battle for the hearts and the souls of the people who voted for Trump because they're now up for grabs from both people who I would say, like Marco Rubio or Nikki Haley, mm-hmm. who are on a more traditional Republican side, and Mitch McConnell, versus the people that we saw turning out, obviously on the Capitol Hill, but, you know, and there are people who didn't support the insurrection that still identify for a more populist Republican Party with Trump still at its head.
And back to James Comey, who spoke about the way forward now.
There's no easy answer to helping a country recover from a fog of lies. There are people of goodwill in this country who believe the virus was a hoax, our institutions are deep state corrupt, and the election was stolen from Donald Trump. To help them out of that fog of lies is going to take years, and you can't do it by shouting at them and telling them that they're idiots. You have to do it by showing them a path out and letting them tell themselves a different story to avoid the embarrassment of admitting they were defrauded. And the big step is what you alluded to. Joe Biden bears that burden and is ready for that burden because he's going to demonstrate, I believe, competent, honest, empathetic leadership. And that's the big step to helping people out of that fog of fraud.
On Wednesday's Drive Time, as the inauguration was still taking place, Cormac spoke to commentator Bonnie Greer.
It's a plea for reconciliation and unity and solidarity. But can President Biden unite a very divided America, in your opinion?
Yes, he can. First of all, remember, we had a civil war. I don't think you can get more divided than that. And came through it. And I'm not saying this to be flippant. It's just that it is possible to do it. He's going to have to, it's going to be a lot of investigation as to what's going on in terms of the white supremacist movement, which the FBI said was the number one terror threat in the United States. So now we have to take that very seriously. But we also have to take the roots of what that is. And we do know from history a lot of what it is and what's been meshed into it. But I think it's possible. I do.
Okay.
I'm very hopeful.
And this is a hopeful day for you?
Absolutely. I mean, the first African-American, South Asian woman and woman made president of the United States. The vice president is male and Jewish. It's just a complete and beautiful example of what this country is at its roots. It's a nation of immigrants and seeking a more perfect union.
Bonnie Greer on Drive Time. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Arena celebrated Dante's Divine Comedy with Dr. Enrica Maria Ferreira of Trinity College, who gave us a guided tour of the circles of hell. Lovely. And she told us who we'd bump into if we decided to stop at circles 8 and 9.
Pimps and seducers and flatterers and simoniacs, who are those who sold church favors and offices. And then you have the barristers, who corrupt politicians. You have hypocrites, thieves and false counselors. And there's all sorts of terrible and horrific punishments that Dante imagines.
Right,
for
so
this
corrupt, corrupt politicians end up in circle 8 of hell, along with thieves and false counselors. There is a lower level than level 8, level 9. These are the causers of division. Who was
oh,
he?
Yes.
And I presume this was a direct comment on the society he was writing in.
Yes, the causes of division, definitely. You know, like those that were causing discord and conflict in society and politics. So it was those, you know, like that he wanted to hit. And for example, down there is Bertrand de Born, who caused the conflict between Henry II of England and his son. And so he was beheaded. And his punishment is that he has to carry around his head severed from his body. He's, in fact, you know, like this happened according to the law of contrapasso, which is like the law that Dante defined and devised, you know, like for assigning the sins, you know, counter penalty.
A kind of karma idea that whatever you did bad on earth, you'll get some version of that down below.
Absolutely. An eye for an eye, you know, like that kind of thing. You know.
And have a listen to Sean Rocks positively rubbing his hands in glee for some deets on just how hellish hell might be for those going down.
Give me an example of one of the most salaciously, deliciously horrific punishments.
Well, for me, you know, like The boiling river of blood for the murderers is terrible, but also the flatterers have to sink in their own excrement, you know, which is like pretty bad, I suppose. You know, like the barriers, so like the politicians, the corrupt politicians, have to be immersed in boiling tar. That is a reference to corrupt and shady and sticky deals, and others. You know, like there's like these people turning into snakes, and the falsifiers and imposters suffer terrible disease like leprosy, rabies, dropsy, and stinking fever. Yeah. There's a thing called stinking fever. It's not the coronavirus, but it's something.
So hell is a pretty horrific place, and fire is.
Oh, the ninth circle of hell would be too good for him. Arena, your go-to for a superior class of literary insult. Now they say never to meet your heroes, but if you do, it might help if you would recognise them. Writer Liz Nugent spoke to Ryan on Thursday. She was working at the Gate Theatre in Dublin and had become friendly with, name drop, Marianne Faithfull, which got her invited to a party at which she bumped into her dentist. Or was he?
I thought I saw my dentist across the room. So yeah. I went over and I was like, hi. And he said, oh, hello. And I realised, oh, he's speaking in English accent, this is not my dentist. And Marianne came over and she said, oh, Liz, have you met Declan? And I said, no, I haven't. And so we started kind of making idle chit-chat, small talk. And I said, what are you doing in Ireland? And he said, I'm a musician and I have a gig coming up in the Gate Theatre. And I said, oh, that's funny, I work there. But you must mean the Gaiety, because the Gate doesn't do gigs. Like, the Gaiety does late-night gigs or the Olympia or whatever. And he said, no, it's definitely the Gate. And I was like, no, it's absolutely not the Gate. The Gate does not do gigs. It's the Gaiety Theatre. I know the names are very similar, but it's the Gaiety Theatre. And he was like, no, I'm pretty sure it's the Gate. And I said, no, the only people we have coming in to do the case is of Costello and the Brodsky Quartet. And he just looked at me, and it took so long for the penny to drop. then I realised I was actually talking to Elvis Costello.
Yeah, Declan McManus, is that his name?
Yeah, Declan McManus.
And you were a fan of the man?
I was a fan of the man.
This makes it even weirder, because he's so distinctive, but you know.
But he wasn't wearing the glasses.
Nah, was he not?
Take off the glasses and
you wouldn't know. Who is he? He's your dentist. That's who he is.
Such a brilliant disguise.
He's your dentist in the dark corner of a room in Marianne Faithfull's house.
I know.
Oh, that's great. And did you kind of confront the awkwardness, or did you walk away?
No, we both just, because he was embarrassed for me and I was embarrassed for me. So we both just kind of turned away gradually, slowly, and talked to other people and avoided each other. It was awful.
Oh, that is painful. And it wasn't to end there. No, she had more.
Carole King.
What did you do with her?
Well, she was in my friend's house. I went around to Rachel Flanagan's house for a cup of tea one Saturday morning, and she said, "Oh, this is Carole. Carole's come to borrow a bicycle or something," and so I was chatting to Carole and she was American, and I said, what are you doing in Ireland?
Oh, here we
the
go
opening
again.
Line.
Yeah, yeah.
And she said, oh, I'm over here doing a show with Peter Sheridan. And I said, oh, that's great. So, you know, I work in theatre too. And, you know, have you done much acting before? And she said, well, I was in Blood Brothers for 6 months on Broadway. And I said, oh, really? Like, what part did you play? And she said, I played Mrs. Johnson, which was obviously the leading role. And I said, oh, so you sing?
She said,
yes, I do, yeah. And then she laughed, and then more to that. And then she laughed, and Rachel turned to me and said, did you not realise that was Carole King?
Lads.
You were like 90 Grammys, and, you know, as one of the most foremost singer-songwriters.
And did you feel the earth move on? No.
Ooh, mortified. Liz Nugent with Ryan. Assignation by Mary Costello told the story of Marion, who'd emigrated from Mayo to Manhattan in 1938. Read by Katrina Niverhu, it was part of Sunday's Spoken Stories, a collection of news stories on the theme of independence.
She walks 3 blocks to the grocery store on 18th Street, stopping at a mailbox to mail the letters. She waits in line in the store and hands her list to the storekeeper. She nods to another housemaid from 23rd Street. Back on the street, she passes three small boys playing marbles. Occasionally she meets a man's eyes and, briefly, something, a flicker of something, passes between them that shames and frightens her. This afternoon she is going on an assignation. This is what Bridget Burke called it. She is to meet Bridget's cousin, Dennis, in Washington Square Park at 4 p.m. They met once before, outside St. Joseph's Church after Mass one Sunday morning. His hair was jet black, and his eyes were brown, and he had a bashful look. But after they moved away from each other, he found her eyes again and smiled, and he did not seem bashful at all.
Ooh, assignation by Mary Costello from last Sunday's Spoken Stories. But catching the glad eye in the middle of a pandemic, you need to be wily as a fox. Comedian Joanne McNally, who spoke to Ray, has a plan.
I'm actually having a ball on the apps at the moment. Great crack, because everyone's bored out of their mind, so everyone's on it. But I think what I'll have to do is wait. I'm assuming, as morbid as it is, that a lot of relationships will break up during lockdown. And then when all those single men come back in the market, I'll pounce. I'm in the wings in a cape waiting for the second wind. I'm waiting for the second wind.
They call that in football the breaking ball. you hang around. If a high ball comes in, two lads jump up for it and you just wait there. Because, you know, in case it just neither of them gets it and you pick it up and run away with it.
That's the leftovers, the scraps of society.
Not really. So that's your strategy. That's your dating plan. Okay.
Exactly, yeah. Just sit back, let everything else fail around me and then kind of go in then and pick up the pieces.
Oh, was your breakup very hard? Come here to me. But given Joanne McNally's profile, surely they'd be flocking to swipe right.
But and this is sort of half serious. But do you not get a lot of attention? Like, you're on the telly, you're a funny woman. You know,
No. I mean, I know, I'm as confused as you, Ray. I really am. Actually, do you know what happened, right? Because I know I'm always banging on about dating, but I do love it. And I was on one of the dating apps. I was like, I've got no interaction here. Like, this traction should be way higher, considering I'm basically a catfish. Like, I'm using all my headshots. And then I realised it's connected to my Instagram account. So once I disconnected that, sure, my likes shot up. Turns out my personality is the problem. So that was a big learning curve for me.
Oh, right. So there's too much information available.
Too much information available, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
So there are things you need to kind of sleep out slowly, you know.
Yeah.
You kind of hide the real you until they're locked in or they've got you pregnant. And then you can just kind of relax into it.
Joanne McNally with Ray. I suspect it is going to be Sodom and Gomorrah when we get out of our cages. In the meantime, let's get a life lesson from maths teacher John Brennan. He spoke to Evelyn O'Rourke on Study Hub. Now, he was ostensibly talking about algebra and logs, but one phrase stood out.
There's a thing called the low partial credit. Now, the low partial credit is awarded for work of any merit. In a 5-mark question, you could get 2 for your low partial credit, and you wouldn't be doing an awful lot. I mean, the bar is not set very high for low partial credits. Just to give you an idea, if you're given a factor and you find the root, that's a low partial credit. If you half differentiate something, it's a low partial credit.
Half differentiated roots? That feels about right. Well, we're almost at a finish here on Playback, but Christy Moore was Miriam's guest on Sunday, and he talked about forming what would become known as Planxty.
The band for about a few months was called Clad, C-L-A-D, but that name didn't inspire, so we started to call ourselves Planxty, which caused a lot of problems at first.
Why?
People couldn't pronounce it. Some people would say Planxty. There was Planxity, Playtex, Plantex. It took a year or so before people got the head around Planxty.
That is it for this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.